Did you see the stylish kids in the riot? Shoveled up like mugs at the night on fire, wombles bleed, truncheons and shields. You know I cherish you, my love.
Welcome to the Young IPA Podcast. I'm James, this is Pete.
G'day everyone.
Now it is the 1st of June, it is episode 62. We've got a huge show for you guys coming up. And if you have always listened to this podcast going, I want to hear more from Dr. Chris Berg, this is a podcast for you. Not only are we going to be interviewing him, he was also at the Freedman Conference last week in Sydney. Thanks again to the Australian Libertarian Society for having us over there. So Chris is going to be talking to a bunch of people over the next few weeks, but today we're going to be playing the interviews as I frantically go through my notes for their names. He's going to be talking to Ilya Shapiro, a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. Really fun chat about some constitutional stuff, and also the editor of Quillette, Claire Lemon. So look out for those interviews, really fun stuff. And yeah, so Pete, big week for news.
It is a big week for news.
Oh, but first off, you know, we've probably got a whole bunch of new listeners after Janet Albrechtson's article on the weekend. So welcome to those new listeners. And guys, I want us on our best behavior for our new friends.
Yeah,
so
no Pete, swearing.
Pete, best behavior. Nina, pressing the buttons, best behavior.
Okay.
Cool. Okay, we're good.
Especially you, Nina.
Especially because you fly off the handle sometimes and we all just pray to God you don't go spraying at us.
I'll stay quiet.
Okay, cool. All right, cool. Let's go through some stories this week. So the big one that broke yesterday, Amazon is cancelling, Australians are blocked from shopping on Amazon's international website. So obviously there's a whole lot of things that we can't buy on Amazon anymore, starting from July 1, and we're going to be redirected to amazon.com.au because of the changes to the GST.
This, I reckon we should start, and we're always on the lookout for segments, but this should be a segment, why Australia can't have nice things.
Exactly. Because taxes.
Yeah, because we're crap. What can you go into a bit more detail about what exactly this entails? So we can't go to...
So we can't ship things from the US website anymore. So it used to be like we could... Well, it still is right now and will be till July 1. But I can order, like I did for my housemate, I ordered his birthday present from the US site because that's the only one I could get it from.
What'd you get him?
I got him a book. It was a nice book.
Safe.
Yes,
good.
Safe. But also tailored to his interests, so it's good. But anyway, so bought the book, really cheap, Amazon US,
Yep. Had
it shipped over, still cheaper than what I would have got. And obviously, it's a pretty hard to find book. Well, not obviously, because you don't know what it is, but it is a hard to find book.
The Bible.
They're not going out of fashion these days, Pete. Very hard to find. I can't rob hotels forever. But it's hard to get over here, so I needed the Amazon. It was really cheap the whole way through. But starting from July 1, I won't be able to do that anymore because the GST changes. Now, here's the thing, though. Jeff Bezos, the guy that's running Amazon, everyone is so scared of like how rich he is and how powerful he is. So everyone's already like, oh, I can't believe Amazon's shirking their tax responsibilities like this. You know, Amazon's a bad guy and the government gets away with it. But lower taxes, encourage investment. Like, this is why we can't have nice things.
That's right. And Trump hates this guy as well, doesn't he?
Trump hates this guy. Can't remember why, but they do not like each other.
So he's just copying it.
Yeah. He's got Trump on side. He's got a bunch of Australians offside. So it's a really bad time to be Jeff Bezos.
Cut Amazon some slack, people. Is the money all worth it?
Yeah, exactly. We can't have nice things. If we just lower taxes, this would be much easier and et cetera, et cetera. The other story this week, Pete, that was pretty big. I don't know if you've heard about it. Kind of went under the radar. But Roseanne, the hit show on the ABC network in the US, has been cancelled.
Roseanne?
Due to the stars and the head writer and sort of the face of the franchise, Roseanne Barr's pretty bad tweet.
Yeah.
Going to be saying? Bad tweet.
Yep.
In a list of tweets that are good and bad, I know where I'm placing this one. If you missed it, she's talking about this Obama aide, and she said she was the Muslim Brotherhood and the Planet of the Apes had a baby. So... really not good stuff.
Yeah.
Definitely do not tweet that out. If you were ever thinking about doing it, don't tweet it. Also, don't think it. It's just really weird.
Yeah.
But the thing, and then obviously everyone under the sun has their own take on this. And, you know, obviously.
As do we.
As do we. Sorry. But we got the good ones. So tune out all the others. Tune out the other people in the world.
Yeah.
Just listen to what me and Pete say. So obviously bad tweet and ABC, you know, it's not exactly every, there was a lot of like, you know, right-wing snowflakes in the US who were like, oh, this is a huge free speech issue. Can't believe this is happening. And it's not. Like ABC, private organization, they can hire and fire who they want.
Yeah.
And Roseanne Barr can still tweet that out. She just can't also say, also I have a show on the ABC network anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah. So not a free speech issue.
No, not at all. Like, my one thing is, what she tweeted is definitely racist.
Mm-hmm.
And the ABC within their rights to sack her if they want. They could not sack her if they want. You know, they could punish her or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, lots of people are out of work because of this decision, but whatever, that's her prerogative. But, as I'm sure you were getting to, the reason people hate her is because she's right-wing, basically.
Yeah, basically. I don't think there's anyone in the US right now going, like, I can't believe she tweeted that. I used to love her and now I hate her. But it's more like, we finally got her.
Would be
the idea of the left. Like, oh, finally. Like, we've been trying for months to shut the show down.
Yeah.
We finally got the smoking gun.
Because she's a Trump supporter. She supports Trump in the actual program.
Yeah, yeah. Like, the pilot episode was her supporting Trump. And, like, that was the main plot line of the first episode of the reboot.
And, sorry, the other point we're going to make, wasn't it, is the hypocrisy of cultural elites, where you can... it's okay for some people to tweet stuff, not other people to tweet stuff. So, you know, as we're saying, we're not defending her at all. It was a bad tweet and she can get sacked. But who was the person that ESPN recently...
Yeah, so Keith Olbermann got rehired by ESPN. He's like, he either does baseball or calls Trump a Nazi online. Like, they're his two modes.
And so why is it worse to call people... What? How come you're allowed to call people a Nazi when they're not...
But you know, well, because you see, Trump is right-wing.
Yeah,
but Obama aides are left wing.
Yeah,
sorry if you're not seeing it by this point. I don't know what to tell you anymore.
I'm sorry, James.
There was also one from a few days ago, like Samantha Bee, who hosts Full Frontal, like a Daily Show kind of show Network, dropped a C bomb talking about Ivanka Trump, like live on air, just drops the C bomb. And Well, two sponsors pulled and she's been forced to apologize, which I'm sure she definitely was like, I deeply regret this thing that I scripted down with my writers, delivered online and rehearsed. Like, I can't believe I said it.
Yeah.
But she's still an employee of TBS.
Yeah. I mean, a C-bomb's not as bad as...
in Australia, it's not as bad. In America, that's... Any Australian out there who's traveled overseas and accidentally dropped a C-bomb knows that our culture is a bit different on C-bombs than other cultures.
I don't know anything about that. It's happened to me.
Anyway.
So we're sort of on the fence, really, with Roseanne.
Yeah, exactly. I kind of think, like... some other network, because it's one of the most profitable shows. Like, the pilot got 18 million views. Like, there's a market out there for it. I think another network's going to wait 5 months for this to cool off and then just be like, by the way, like, here's a contract, but you also have to not tweet.
To diversity training.
I think so. Yeah, one session of diversity training was all that Roseanne needed.
Right.
Should we move on to another story?
Yes.
All right, so should we go Italy?
Yeah, because that's tough. Let's get that out of the way.
There's a lot of big thinking that needs to go on with this Italy story.
I don't know if listeners know this, but we, I don't know, the tricky stuff is tricky for us.
Well, as Pete, Chris Berg says, some people like to tune in for the ignorance of me and Pete.
That's a direct one.
which we didn't love.
No, we didn't. I didn't accept that.
Cool. So, this one is complicated. So, Italy obviously had an election. Got a lot of play. It was the triumph of the populist parties, pretty right-wing parties, very anti-EU parties. But they didn't get a clear enough majority. It's kind of thrown the country into a bit of political turmoil. So
they weren't fully right-wing. They were sort of populist.
Yeah,
some left-wing policies, some right-wing policies.
Yeah, basically.
But they were very anti-establishment, anti-Euro.
Very anti-Euro.
But you're doing a great job.
Thank you. So President Sergio Mattarella... A few weeks ago, refused to submit to the demands that he approved the proposed economy minister. So obviously the parties that have got enough seats, but they can't form government, were like, okay, this is our economy minister.
Yeah.
Now, this economy minister does not like the euro at all and definitely has a plan to exit the eurozone.
Yep.
And so the president, who is very pro-EU, was like, that's not my guy. Try again.
And the president's like a semi-democratic position in Italy.
Yeah, yeah. It's sort of like the governor general from what I could read.
But a little bit more. Yeah,
yeah, a little bit more.
But less power than, say, Trump.
Yes. So, I mean, like, that's really weird. You can't really just say, yeah, the democratic elected thing, not vibing it, guys. So go back, have another huddle, come back to me with a better solution.
Like, exactly.
So Italy's going to have another election in August because of it.
Yeah.
What I don't get is, so obviously this president, Sergio Mattarella, like, loves the EU, didn't want to be the guy that let in the populist anti-EU people.
Mm-hmm.
What's his endgame here? Like, what? Like, the whole country's going to go, okay, all right, fine. We'll get the pro-EU guy.
Yeah.
We thought about it. We had a cool down. We want the pro-EU guy after they literally just destroyed who we've tried to vote for.
Well, I don't know how these normally go when there has to be another election straight away. But, I mean, my instinct would be, wouldn't they just chuck back the same results? Or wouldn't they...
No, like, Yeah.
Or unless there's resentment that they have to vote again. Maybe.
I would say the anti-EU party is going to win by an even bigger majority.
Okay.
Because so it's like their whole thing of just like the EU's destroying our democracy. They now have a smoking gun. Like,
yeah.
The EU or the EU supporters have stopped a populist government taking power.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, that sounds vaguely logical, James.
Thank you.
But,
ignorant. So, yeah. Eat it, Chris Berg. What's ignorant about that one?
Eat it. Yeah, so these parties, I don't necessarily like. In fact, I despise some of their policies. You know, this one of these blokes has one of the leaders of one of the parties, the more extreme one, has a Putin infatuation, which I find despicable. But that's democracy, kids.
Yeah, sometimes you lose.
Right. Yeah, sometimes you lose.
So
I had to really process that before I came back with my response. Yeah.
Yeah, cool. So we got two more stories we're going to get through. This intro is running long, but it was a huge week in news.
Oh, there's lots of stuff.
Yeah. So another one that went viral on Twitter was, the story broke this week that ICE, so like the immigration department in the US, have lost 1,500 kids. They don't know where they are. So the story is, so when families come to the American border and they want to illegally immigrate, you imprison, like the idea is in Trump's new policy, the parents would be imprisoned for illegal trespassing, but you can't imprison kids and you can't send them to the same federal thing. So obviously these children need to be taken to sponsored families and one day reunited. But the problem is that they've lost 1,500 kids through to bureaucratic nightmares, I guess. So obviously terrible story. We can't have that. Apparently there's a whole lot of like secondary thoughts of like, is it 1,500? Is it because of this policy? But it seems to be like there's been a lot of kids, both in Trump's policies and Obama's policies. But anyway, Jon Favreau, who runs Pod Save America, a huge podcast in the US, he used to be a speechwriter for Obama, tweeted out, here are some photos, look at these pictures, this is happening right now, can't believe that this is a US government that would do this. So, like, you've got two children asleep and, like, just behind a fence, it looks pretty bad.
It's
like,
terrible, yeah.
Yeah, it's worse than a prison cell, and you've got two 10-year-old kids sleeping there.
Mm, on the ground.
Yeah, but the thing is, and everyone tweeted it, how bad's Obama, yeah, how bad's Obama. The thing is, it came out in 2014 when it was Obama.
No, how bad's Trump?
How bad's Trump?
Yep.
No one was saying how bad's Obama. Yeah, that's the whole point of the story. But it came out, the photos were actually taken in 2014. So when it was the Obama administration. Yeah. So, and that then goes into, it's like, whenever someone says, oh, Obama never had a scandal, it's because the media weren't doing enough. Like, surely if you were involved in the media, you would remember those photos from 2014. Like, I think I'm remembering those photos 4 years from now. But no one was like, hang on, I've seen that photo before. Everyone's like, nope, okay, Trump, bad guy.
This kind of hypocrisy really gets on my goat,
yep,
James.
Good.
There's stuff, obviously, I mean, this is a prime example, you know. Obama killed 324 civilians with, you know, drone killings.
Yep.
Jacinda Ardern.
Blew up a wedding.
Jacinda Ardern wants to halve immigration. Paul Keating introduced mandatory detention. ALP and Labor movement were central in bringing about the White Australia policy. Yet, it's all Trump's fault.
Yeah, it's actually Trump's fault.
What the blind spot of the left over when their own parties do this immigration stuff is amazing.
Yeah.
I remember, I always get into discussion of parties and stuff. I'm always like, bang, 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 X, Y, Z. And people just are like, that's not true.
Yeah.
Like, it is.
It is actually true. I remember like, remember how, like, when the Cambridge Analytica stuff broke up, there was, like, the story that it also happened in Australia. There was, like, the Age wrote an article saying the Liberal Party were offered all these people's data to advertise to. And then if you read the article forward, it was, like, the Liberal Party said no. And then if you read even more, it was, like, the Labor Party said yes, like, they'll do it.
Yeah.
And so I remember, like, people coming up to me going, I can't believe the Liberal Party would do that. I can't believe it. And I'm like, yeah, but Labor, they didn't do it and Labor did do it. And they're like, oh, but that's okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway. Cool. So last story we've got to talk about here. So obviously, we talked about this on the podcast a fair bit.
Yes.
The Right to Try.
Yep.
Deborah Sims, if you want to go back through our archives, if you're new to the show, we talked to IPA development team member Deborah Sims, who obviously has a very personal history with Right to Try, this being the ability for patients with terminal diseases or life-threatening diseases to try unproven drugs, I guess, not FDA-approved drugs.
That's
so
right.
So experimental drugs to see if it would work. To us, it seems like an absolute no-brainer. Obviously, you want to try everything you can.
Yeah.
But for some reason, there's a lot of hold-ups as to like, oh, you can't have that drug yet. You've got to wait the 3 years it takes to get clearance. And it's like, well, I don't have 3 years. Can I try it now?
Exactly right.
But anyway, so actual huge story. So President Trump has signed a bill giving terminally ill patients the right to try this week. So that's pretty huge. Hopefully it's a huge step forward for internationally. Because in America, you could sign, you'd have to get permission and stuff like that. And
some states were different to others.
Yeah, but this is like federal. Anyone can try if they're terminally ill, which is huge.
That's right. Access to investigational drugs have increased. It means that the drug manufacturers, so all a person needs is the approval of their physician and the drug manufacturer are happy to sell it to them. And it means that drug manufacturers and physicians can do this stuff without liability, and it means people can try experimental drugs when they're dying, as you explained. I understand that they don't want people taking drugs that are going to be bad for them, but surely, you know, if you had a few weeks to live, you'd be willing to roll the dice, and we should be giving people that choice.
Yeah, absolutely.
So Deb seems to take a bow.
Yes.
Because she obviously advises Donald Trump.
Yeah, did this interview sway Donald Trump? Is this podcast in his ear?
Well, we should take a bow too.
Yeah, absolutely. And we should get him on the podcast.
We should. I keep saying.
Yeah, cool. So let's go to our interviews now. So we've got, as I said, Chris Berg, Ilya Shapiro, and Claire Lemon from Colette. It's a huge smorgasbord of interviews, and you guys are going to really enjoy them. But before we do, obviously this podcast is available on iTunes, SoundCloud, our website, and through our Hey What Did I Miss email. So make sure you guys are subscribed on any of those channels you prefer. If you are subscribed on iTunes, if you could leave us a 5-star review, really helps us out with the rankings.
We don't like fours, do we?
We don't like fours.
We don't like threes. Do we take fours?
Very against two. Well, they have the option to give us a four.
No, but do we... Would we accept them?
It'd be like a small tip on a big bill in a fancy restaurant. It's like, well, thank you, but also, come on, mate.
But our average is above four, don't give us fours.
We're inundated with fives.
Okay.
You can be the first person to give us a 4-star review. Why would you? Yeah. Join the majority. Don't give us that five. Cool. So, yeah, personal best for the podcast. We get up to number 16 on news and politics internationally, but downloaded in Australia, so that's pretty cool. Nina, what can people do if they want to get around the IPA on a bigger level than this podcast?
Just become a member. Just visit our website, ipa.org.au, and click on that join button. And starting as low as $22 per year, you become a member for 12 months. We will receive 4 free editions of IPA reviews, magazines, and also exclusive invitations to our events.
Okay, cool. Let's go to those interviews now. Okay, we are now joined once again by Senior Research Fellow at RMIT and Senior Fellow here at the IPA, Dr. Chris Berg. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
No worries. So, big week for you, Chris. We've launched two of your books, one of them Against Public Broadcasting, which we've talked about already a little bit, and also the launch of Australia's Red Tape Crisis. So we'll get into Against Public Broadcasting first.
Two books in 1 week.
Yeah, in a 7-day period. Big
week. I'm pretty tired. Yeah.
So, Against Public Broadcasting. So, what's this book about, and how have you found the reception of it so far?
Well, so this is a book published with my RMIT colleague, Sinclair Davidson, who, of course, is also a senior fellow at the IPA, and published by Connor Court and available on the Connor Court website. Our argument is that the ABC is an anachronism. It was founded originally in 1932 to deal with some very specific economic issues in the broadcasting market at the time, a very, very, very early period for radio broadcasting in that case. And it has just survived. It's just stayed and grown and gotten more responsibilities and made a bigger bureaucratic space for itself. Our argument, though, is in this time of technological change and digital media convergence and massive media plenty, there's not really a reason to have a public broadcaster. It doesn't make sense. And of course, we go into all the other consequences of the ABC: its cost, its effect on the market for media ideas and the market for political opinion, and of course. We detail the issues with ABC bias. We detail the issues with rural and regional broadcasting and all that sort of thing. But the main story we have is that, you know, the ABC is a public policy program, and it does not necessarily suit the needs of the state.
Excellent. Well, why don't you jump in and tell us about book two then, Australia's Red Tape Crisis?
Yeah, sure. So this is an edited volume, again, published by Connor Court. This time it's edited with my RMIT colleague, Darcy Allen, who, again, is also an adjunct fellow at the IPA. And this is a collection of papers on the various dimensions, or a collection of essays, really, on the various dimensions of the red tape burden in Australia. So we go through the relationship between red tape and environmental law, red tape and the criminal law, red tape and technological change. We come up with some new ideas about how governments can reduce the red tape burden, and really spell out. We've even got, you know, stories about red tape history, the origins of the bureaucratic red tape state in Australia. We're trying to tackle it from as many different angles as possible because we think this is red tape and overregulation more generally, and regulatory control is really one of the most significant issues facing the Australian economy.
Oh, no, I was going to go to the next question, but you were still going, so that's my bad. So,
all good. So the IPA has found, as I'm sure all listeners of the Young IPA podcast know, that red tape costs the Australian economy around $176 billion a year in lost economic output. But it also has some really concerning other consequences. Just, you know, on top of that price, which is a very large price, it has some other consequences. It makes the country less resilient. It makes us less adaptable to technological or economic changes. You know, one of the ways I like to think about regulation is, imagine there's an economic downturn, and people lose their jobs and need to move into other jobs, and other businesses need to start up, or people need to start up as independent contractors and so forth. If it's really hard to start a business, it's going to be really hard to adjust to that economic downturn. So it is with technological change. If you've been kicked out of work because, you know, a robot took your job, we want you to be in the best position to be able to start a new business. But if we've got regulations that prevent you starting a new business or make it harder to start a new business, it's going to be harder for you to find work. This regulation has not just economic costs, or not just direct sort of financial costs, I should say, but it affects the dynamism of our economy, and it hurts real people.
Okay, brilliant. So once again, you can buy both of those books at Connacourt Publishing and their website. So let's also talk another reason this was a big week for Dr. Chris Berg. So last week was obviously the Friedman Conference, something we were talking about with Tim Andrews, and we had a few guests that we were going to be playing interviews from. Mm. But also a big week for Chris in that you were awarded the Libertarian of the Year. So congratulations first. So
let's give a Q&A clap.
Give a Q&A clap.
Okay. Thank you.
What was it like winning the award?
Two books in a week. That's how you win Libertarian of the Week. Well, what is it called?
At least there's a payoff. Yeah. it's very exciting. It's quite an honour. I've been going to every one of the Friedman, the Australian Libertarian Society conferences since they began when they were very small. There were 50 or so people, and now there are nearly 400 people who come along to this really, really, it's very intellectually stimulating, but it's also a celebration of the movement. It's a demonstration of the size and strength and intellectual caliber of the Liberty movement across the country. So it's very exciting. It's a real honor to be, provided, you know, given that honor. It's my community. and to be honoured by your community is a very nice thing.
Cool. So as you said, you had a lot of questions. You'd been there a few times. What was it, do you think, that put you over the edge this year against all your other competitors?
Just a lot of typing. you just keep typing, and eventually people give you prizes. That's always been my strategy.
What other... That's your prize strategy. Okay, that's quite good. Just keep typing, everyone. What other people have won this award over the years? Is this your first time winning it?
It's my first time winning it. I don't think I can win it twice.
That is ridiculous.
No. I stand at the sword of giants. Sinclair Davidson won it last year. So who was my PhD supervisor? There's no way I could get it before him, obviously.
Still mine.
I think James Patterson has won it. David Leonhelm has won it, and there are lots of other prizes for, you know, young activists. And in fact, the IPA's very own Renee Gorman won the Young Activist Award.
Cool. Yeah, that was it.
At the Libertarian Conference this year. So no. I'm honoured to be sort of part of such a intellectually and politically influential group of people.
Absolutely. So let's talk about the Freedman Conference in general. So a lot of the staff members here at the IPA who went to the conference and have come back have been absolutely raving about a lot of the speakers that they heard, a lot of the sessions that they saw. Who were your favourite speakers, or what was your favourite thing that you saw at the conference?
I always love getting the international speakers. So I think the Australian speakers are fantastic, and you know, there are a lot of diverse ideas and so forth. But I always get a real kick out of the people that come all the way down to Australia. This year, there are a few really key people. Tom Palmer, I know you've interviewed, is a wonderful friend of the IPA and a wonderful friend of the Australian Libertarian Movement. But there was also Jeffrey Tucker. So Jeffrey Tucker is an American libertarian. He's a fascinating character. He's very interested in the things that I'm interested in, which is, you know, cryptocurrencies and blockchain as well. So it was great to hear from him. It was great to hear from Ilya Shapiro. It was great to hear from Jonathan Blanks, both from Cato, on their areas of expertise, which is law and police reform. So, I love to hear from the internationals. It's a great opportunity. I mean, it's like it's a conference. So the part of the appeal of a conference is meeting people in the lunch queue and those side conversations that you have. And that's where I think the value of this conference, as much as any, comes from.
Awesome. Now, you also were involved in interviewing a few of these guests for the Young IPA podcast. How did you find that experience? Not as easy as it looks, is it, mate?
Look, I'm just waiting for feedback from you guys.
Oh, you know? No worries.
It would be hard to top your incredibly skillful presentation
style. What I do is say the thing they're interested in and then tell us about that. So, like,
yeah,
Chris, ABC, tell us about that.
That gives you an opportunity to tell what you think about that. Yeah, it's really effective. You really cut to the chase.
We'll talk another thing that's been happening in your life at the moment. So recently you attended a cryptocurrency convention. I think you were in New York or some city in America. What was that all about?
Yeah, so Sinclair Davidson, Jason Potts, director of the RMIT Blockchain Innovation Hub, and my colleague at RMIT, of course. We went over, Associate Professor Ellie Rennie, who's also part of the RMIT Blockchain Innovation Hub. We went over to Consensus, the big blockchain cryptocurrency conference in the United States and really around the world. It's the premier yearly event. And it's been going for quite a few years. And it was enormous. There were 8,500 people there at the Hilton in New York. It was it was actually really interesting. So from my perspective, I didn't learn a lot about the technology. I didn't necessarily learn a lot about the economics of the technology, but we learned a lot about where the industry is going. And the direction the industry is going is there's really big institutional players like Amazon Web Services announced a product from the stage to do with blockchain. Microsoft, the Jack of Twitter fame, was on the stage as well. So it was really significant to see these very large, very significant firms feeling that they have to be involved in the blockchain market, as well as countries. So the Australian government had a big stand. In fact, there was an Australia room.
Good?
It was very good insofar as they were the only place that did good coffee. They actually got a coffee machine. So if you could get a flat white at Consensus rather than this, you know, awful conference coffee stuff.
Not all government expenditure is bad, Chris.
Yeah, look. Obviously, I'll descend the coffee to the hilt. The Premier of Bermuda, so that the leader of the Bermuda government, was on stage announcing his intention for that government to be blockchain friendly, or what we call crypto friendly, which is really interesting by itself because it means that countries are now competing to attract blockchain firms and the cryptocurrency and blockchain market. That's a really exciting, from my perspective, that's a really exciting new dynamic because it tells us that that we're seeing the same sort of competition in crypto-friendliness, blockchain public policy friendliness, as we are in, you know, international tax competition and regulatory competition and so forth.
Absolutely. That's a really cool sign. So I've noticed that you went over to the Hilton Hotel in great New York City. Really cool thing. I want to point out that one of our colleagues that we've mentioned here on the show, on this interview, Darcy Allen, made his way over to Papua New Guinea. So what was the decision process on who went to New York versus who went to Papua New Guinea?
Is that hierarchical?
Look, yeah, completely hierarchical. look, it would be nice to say that we did rock, paper, scissors, but we didn't. We just sent Darcy to Papua.
All right, cool. Chris, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
No, thanks, guys.
My name's Chris Berg. I'm here with Claire Lehman, editor of the online magazine Quillette. Claire, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
So tell us a little bit about Quillette.
Okay, so Quillette is a cultural, political, and science news website. We publish many long-form articles, which go into some topics in quite an in-depth manner. We publish articles written by professional writers, but we also publish scientists, students, a range of people. We aim for political diversity and pluralism, so we don't have a particular line that we try to run. My only criteria for exclusion is epistemological. So if you are a postmodernist or a post-structuralist and you think that reality is created by language and there's no such thing as objective truth, then we're not going to publish your article. But other than that, we're very open. And we accept pitches from all over the world on all sorts of different topics.
Well, that's really interesting. So I mean, taking that epistemological approach, I've never heard an online magazine describe its approach as an epistemological one, which is fantastic, and a really unique thing about Quillette. So, what sort of pitches are you getting? What sort of themes are emerging from your writers?
Yeah, so we get a lot of pitches from young people who want to explore some kind of dangerous or taboo topics in a measured and evidence-based manner. So a recent article that we published written by an undergraduate at Columbia was about racism and how disparities in outcomes are not necessarily always caused by discrimination. And he marshaled a lot of evidence to present this case. And he's a young African-American student. And he wanted to present his case, which was very well argued, logically presented, and thoughtful. And he said to us, I just don't know anywhere else that would publish this piece because it's on a sensitive issue, race. It was over 3,000 words long, and he dealt with it in a very non-polemic, sort of measured way. So we're just filling that gap at the moment. We don't publish, clickbait, polemics, sort of tribal screeds. We like to publish sort of scholarly. We like the tone to be reasonably neutral and objective. But also, we're getting a lot of writing that has literary merit as well, which is fantastic for us and the reader.
So it's obviously, it seems like there's been demand and there's obviously been a supply of writers.
Yes, yeah.
How did you discover this this gap in the market? Was this a hunch? How did you come to the hunch?
Oh, well, I think I was a reader and a consumer of media myself, and I just wanted there to be a website that reflected some more nuanced positions than what I was seeing. And we all know that people who work in media have training in the humanities and not necessarily in the empirical sciences or quantitative sciences. So I knew that there was a gap and that there would be a lot of readers who had an appetite for more rigorous kind of analysis. And I was lucky enough to have a social network where which I could draw on, and I knew quite a few academics and scholars who were happy to contribute writing sort of pro bono when I started, so I had a steady flow of content without much cost. So I was lucky in that respect, yeah.
And the New York Times, as I understand, has referred to you in as a member of the intellectual dark web, which I'd love to hear your views on. How has it changed your life becoming a member, being identified as a member of the intellectual dark web? Take us through how you see that story and how that's played out for you.
Oh, it was fun, a bit of fun. I think there's opportunities, but also drawbacks in having that kind of label. I think the first thing we don't want to do is to become a tribe. So the people that are apparently in this intellectual dark web, you know, there's a range of different people, but as if we all start thinking of ourselves as a cohesive tribe, then we're going to sort of fall prey to the biases that we complain about in other people.
So it's people like Sam Harris, Jordan Peterson, Jonathan Haidt, Steven Pinker, those sorts of people.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a very diverse group.
That's right.
In field, in attitude, perspective, that sort of thing, I would have thought.
Yeah. I don't know if you would really put people like Pinker and Haidt into the intellectual dark web. I mean, it depends how you define it. There's certainly scholars who have a big following online and who are attractive to young people in particular, who are craving the kind of educational stimulation that they're not getting from their courses at university. But the intellectual dark web I see is more of an online community where people are testing out new ideas and are directly communicating with an audience. So obviously, you know, you've got people with podcasts like Joe Rogan and Dave Rubin, and you've got, you know, Jordan Peterson, who's directly communicating with his YouTube audience. And so I think it's that communication with an online audience without having to go through any kind of mainstream institution, I think that's probably the defining characteristic.
Does that say that it's the technology that suddenly empowered a group of people, or is it just the time is right for this sort of?
It must be both. So I think what's cool about the intellectual dark web, if you want to call it that, is simply that these people like Sam Harris, Jordan Peterson, and others have views, opinions, and considered respectable views in mainstream media, particularly in America. But that hasn't stopped them because of the internet. And because of the internet, they're not actually censored at all. And they have developed huge followings of their own simply by bypassing those traditional prestige institutions such as mainstream media and to some extent the universities.
What sort of strikes me about that list, and whether we put Haidt or Pinker on, they're sort of a group of dissidents or something.
Yeah.
But what strikes me about them is that they tend to be, I mean, I'm an economist, but these are, we're talking about psychologists, sort of yeah. behavioral scientists, social biologists,
and so forth.
Why do you think that is?
I think that's a great question. I think the reason is that the humanities has presented a version or a view of human nature, which is one view, which is in conflict with what you learn in the behavioral sciences. One thing that I notice in op-eds that are published in the Guardian or left-leaning news sites like The Independent is this power struggle interpretation of human nature and society. So if you imagine that society, in society there is an oppressed class and then there's an oppressor class. So you can, that has many different interpretations, like women are oppressed by men or people of colour are oppressed by white people or LGBTI people are oppressed by straight people. It's kind of this view, this interpretation which always sees power and oppression as being central. In the behavioral sciences, behavior and social behavior is not put through those kinds of the power relationships between classes doesn't really come into it, and you'll be looking at all sorts of different variables. You'll be building complicated models, and you'll be looking at things like evolution, biology. And so I think there's a clash in basic perspectives on people and society that is almost causing this schism, if you could call it that, between those who have been trained in humanities fields, which view everything through this Marxian conflict theory, and those who have been trained in the behavioral sciences, which take a more empirical and acknowledge that there are many variables affecting behavior, not just power.
And what do you sort of take the political lesson out of that difference to be? What does knowing that science or working in those fields, what does that teach you at the political level?
I think that it teaches you that social questions, social problems are not always easily answered by a simplistic solution. And a lot of people in this intellectual dark web there's a diverse range of political views, but they're pretty much united in being opposed to a hard left kind of they're opposed to this hard left Marxist interpretation where patriarchy has to be smashed, white supremacy has to be smashed for there to be freedom. I think understanding the behavioral sciences allows one to see that social phenomena is complex, and you can't bring simplistic slogans to these problems and expect them to be fixed. And there are also going to be unintended consequences and things like that, which you have to prepare for.
Well, Claire Lehman, thank you so much for joining the Young IPA podcast.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Have a great rest of the weekend.
Thank you. Cheers.
My name's Chris Berg. I'm a senior fellow with the Institute of Public Affairs, and I'm here with Ilya Shapiro. Ilya is a senior fellow in constitutional studies at the Cato Institute. Welcome, Ilya.
That's right, just a couple of fellows talking.
Exactly. So we're talking at the Freedmen 2018 conference in Sydney, and you've come down here to be on one of the panels on the rule of law, am I right?
Well, I did a panel on U.S. politics, which I thought went rather well. People interested in this weird age that we're living in, and then concluding the conference with a lecture on the importance of rule of law to economic development.
Okay, so what's your role at Cato?
I've been there just over a decade, which is remarkable. I sort of got my dream job when I was 30, and nobody's been able to give me a better offer. I straddle the academic, political, media, and legal worlds. It's really a fun position in the sense that sometimes I'm a scholar writing law review articles and other academic-y things. Sometimes I'm a media pundit going on TV or blogging or what have you and being on Twitter, getting involved in the discussion. Sometimes I'm a lawyer filing briefs, overseeing our large program of trying to influence the courts and regulatory agencies in various filings. And sometimes I'm meeting with members on the Hill or talking about judicial nominations and trying to move policy. So it's really interesting job. And so some people describe think tank work as kind of being like a university professor but without students, and that's not quite right, because that's only, as I just said, about a quarter of the work.
One thing I love the Cato Institute. It's a free market libertarian think tank, and one thing that I really like about what they do is they get themselves involved not just in public policy but in judicial cases as well. Is that, do you find that's a very effective way to operate as a think tank? Does that make the change that we want to make?
Yeah, Cato's amicus brief program, friend of the court, they're called briefs. We don't represent clients ourselves. We get involved in cases that are already pending, and we offer a different perspective. It has become a rather effective way of getting our message out, and the way that we write our briefs aren't isn't just to be very legalese and technical and lawyerly, because we recognize that our audience isn't just the judges and their clerks. It's also the media. It's also people who are interested in legal policy and things like that. So we try very hard to make our briefs actually in English rather than legalese. And then we spin off opinion articles and blog posts and things like that from them. Sometimes I convert them into short law review pieces or what have you. So we really try to... I guess what consultants would say, synergize our products and spin them out into all sorts of different areas. And with our legal brief program, it's really been a Hayekian spontaneous order, because when I joined Cato, like I said, over a decade ago, it's not like I thought, oh, well, that's a niche that we're not exploiting. We need to file more briefs. It just so happened I came from private practice, and a lot of my friends and former colleagues would jump at the chance of writing a brief for the Supreme Court rather than other type of volunteer pro bono legal opportunities. And so we had it snowballed. Lots of firms jumped at the opportunity to do a brief for Cato, and now it's a best practice of the leading Supreme Court advocates to try to get Cato on your side.
Oh, fantastic. So you've been forced to speak at 9 a.m. tomorrow morning on the importance of rule of law.
Sunday morning to be Sunday clear morning, to the listeners. Sorry, yeah.
So we're recording on this on Saturday, and poor old Ilya has to wake up early tomorrow and speak to a large crowd, I'm assuming.
As long as they show up, I don't care how hungover they are. Maybe we'll have some hair of the dog. I certainly need a flask.
I mean,
you can always
drink through. That's what I was saying.
Right.
But you're going to speak on the importance of rule of law to economic development. That's two, as I would often say, separate concepts: rule of law and economic development. Can you tie them together?
They're interrelated in the sense that to be able to have economic growth, you need the rules of the game to be stable, to be clear, to be transparent. Mm-hmm. And for it to be the rule of law rather than of a particular person or people who are appointed and can change their minds arbitrarily. That goes to stability and to being able to plan your affairs, whether personal affairs or business affairs. And as I've been fortunate in my life, in my career, to travel and work and study in various countries around the world, England, Argentina, Canada, Russia, different places in Europe and Latin America. This is now my first time in Australia. It's just so important, setting aside differences in culture, which is well enough, but there need to be, as I said, a structure, an institutional infrastructure, if you will. And as a constitutional lawyer, that's very interesting to me that I try to help achieve that or explain that and let my smarter, more math-oriented economist friends take it from there.
and in the United States, where are you seeing the big disputes in this space? Where is the rule of law being eroded in the biggest concern?
The last decade or two, the growth of the administrative state, meaning the bureaucracy, which is sort of an uncontrolled fourth or fifth or sixth branch of government. We talk about there's traditionally the separation of powers, the legislative, the executive, and the judicial power. Well, this administrative branch is its own kind of a deus ex machina, this unaccountable separate organ that keeps growing, and it faces an incentive structure to aggrandize its power more and more. And people feel disaffected from that because it's not their lawmakers making the law. It's these bureaucrats who sometimes don't even claim to be making law, but they issue what are called guidance letters, which cautious lawyers will advise their clients, whether they be universities or businesses, oh, well, we should really follow these guidance letters because those agencies have real power over us.
Yeah, this regulation by press release, we have that in Australia as well.
You joke about things like that, but during the Obamacare rollout, the big healthcare reform under President Obama, things would get changed on the fly, literally by blog post and press release and press conference. And it's very hard to advise your client, whether you're in the public or the private sector as a lawyer, what to do when these things change. This is the literal antithesis to the rule of law.
Look, I find it interesting because in Australia and at the IPA and part of our scholarly work, we spend a lot of time talking about the Australian regulatory state. But the Australian regulatory state only dates back a couple of decades. The United States kind of invented the regulatory state because unlike Australia or the United Kingdom, you guys never really mass socialized. You didn't nationalize all your industries. Instead, you regulated them. And now, when I look at the United States, it seems like this is this is the path that we're heading down. How can we suppress this problem? I'm asking you an unanswerable question.
Yeah.
But what, well, where know, can we go?
Yeah, you know, my role is in public education and in advocacy in terms of filing these briefs and regulatory comments. But it's a matter of political culture. At the end of the day, you can have the most beautifully designed institutions and constitutions, but if the people don't care or have no faith in it, then it's a parchment barrier, as Thomas Jefferson put it. So this is not just, I should add, this is not just in the economic sphere. So many parts of the culture wars in America are now played out through regulation, mandates, and other things, not simply taxing and spending, but shrinking and squeezing civil society such that it's either the government or your own house, and everything else, what used to be called public spaces or public institutions, but non-governmental, those are being shrunk. And that's a dangerous trend because it hurts everything from individual autonomy and civil society to religious liberty to just things that the government at whichever level. This is not necessarily a federalism issue. That's a separate kettle of fish, but that the government really has no business being involved in.
Religious liberty is a really interesting one because that's quite a controversial area at the moment. We had a same-sex marriage debate, and same-sex marriage was passed in Australia. But the question is, what sort of protections can we give religious people? How has that debate played out in the U.S.?
I imagine the same way as it is here. Justice Kennedy, who's the swing vote on the court and wrote the majority opinion, was the deciding vote in our same-sex marriage case, wrote in that opinion that he was not disparaging anyone who opposed same-sex marriage. This is lots of people in good faith have various views, whether based on religion or otherwise. This is not bigotry. This is not someone who believes that the races should be segregated, where there cannot really be a benevolent reason for holding that view. And yet, in so many spaces, indeed, those who oppose same-sex marriage are being squeezed, whether wedding vendors or other types of institutions. And I think fundamentally it's because people miss the distinction between public and private actors or government versus non-government actors. And so I think the right to same-sex marriage, if the government is going to be involved in giving out marriage licenses, query why that is, but if they are going to be giving out these marriage licenses, then yeah, I don't think they should be discriminating on the basis of or distinguishing people on the basis of sexual orientation. But individual actors, whether they be businesses or individuals, private citizens, are not agents of the state. And so their freedom of conscience, whether based on religion or otherwise, should be preserved. There's a big case at the Supreme Court now, which will be decided by the end of next month, about a baker in Colorado who has had lots of gay clients and happy to sell muffins and brownies and birthday cakes and what have you, but will not make a cake specifically for a same-sex wedding. And I think his rights to do that, I think, should be vindicated. In fact, the closest wedding cake shop that actively advertises same-sex wedding cakes is less than a tenth of a mile down the street. So this is not a situation where if this couple can't get a cake from him, they're out of luck and they're not going to have cake at their wedding. So,
oh well, thank you very much, Ilya. Thank you for joining us on the Young IPA podcast.
My pleasure. It's great to be in Australia.
Okay, thank you to Ilya Shapiro, Chris Berg, and Claire Lemon for those interviews. That was very interesting stuff. So now let's go through some stories that made us laugh this week. If I may start off, Pete.
You can start, James.
Now, obviously, regressive taxes, Pete and I have long... Well, obviously, most people would kind of see regressive taxes as them being taxes that sort of try and push poor people's behavior into one way or the other.
Yes.
Well, we've always seen that as, like, that's the end goal. Like, there's no other reason for regressive taxes than to stop poor people smoking or stop poor people eating junk food.
Yeah, sometimes they're accidents, but accidents or trying to make decisions for people because you don't think they earn enough money to be smart enough to make them for themselves.
Yes, exactly. So Michael Bloomberg has just basically proven us right. He joined Christine Lagarde at the International Monetary Fund and had this to say.
Some people say, well, taxes are regressive, but in this case, yes, they are. That's the good thing about them, because the problem is in people that don't have a lot of money. And so higher taxes should have a bigger impact on their behavior and how they deal with themselves. So I listen to people saying, oh, we don't want to tax the poor. Well, we want the poor to live longer so that they can get an education and enjoy life.
And so this is just for us. Whenever someone says regressive taxes, like, oh, it's not about making poor people, bullying poor people. It's like, well, actually, it is.
At least he's honest.
The world's most famous regressive taxer, the guy that tried to bring in the soda tax in New York City, has openly said it's about pushing people around.
My favorite bit, and I'm not sure if this is included in the clip or not, is why do we pander to these people?
Yeah.
It's like, pander, do you mean afford them the basic rights of living in a democracy?
Yeah, exactly.
And as Chris Berger always says, if people can't decide what, you know, Coke they drink, then why should they be allowed to vote?
Mm-hmm.
Which is a good thing.
And yeah, it's also another one to hunt around of just like, do you think they should be voting?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, That's what I reckon. Because I say that to people when I'm just having this discussion informally in a social setting. And like the amount of times they'd be like, no, this just people are stupid. They should, is like, oh.
Yeah.
Oh, that's not what I thought you'd say.
Yeah. Well, interesting.
Anyway.
Cool. So Pete, let's talk breathalyzers.
Well, James, let's talk breathalyzers. 250,000 fake breath tests over 5 years by the Victorian police to meet their targets.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just emerged from the watchdog that because police don't have enough time to breath test all the people that they're meant to breath test according to their guidelines, they have made 250,000 fake breath tests where they just do it themselves or they put their finger over the straw or something. I don't know.
Well, you skipped over the lead there. They put their finger over the straw.
Yeah.
Which makes this a straw man argument.
Oh,
the new hit segment from the Young IPA
the hit
podcast.
New segment. That's why we got up to number 16 this week. 250 fake breath tests. It's part of I've sort of put together here a list of inglorious acts by the police in the last few years. An hour and 10 minutes to board that plane at Tullamarine Airport where there was a bloke claiming he had a bomb because I couldn't find this reported as much as it was at the time, that they couldn't find the equipment they needed for the, whatever it's called.
I remember they bought the stairs to get the people off the plane and it took a while to get there. And then when it got there, the stairs couldn't reach the plane because they bought the wrong stairs.
Yeah. So that's one.
Cutting edge Victoria police.
They were assaulting people they'd already arrested. Remember that came out last week, a few weeks ago, including a bloke on a disability pension. There was controversy about how they dealt with the Bourke Street thing. That maniac was driving around for hours before they didn't try and stop him or anything like that.
The closest anyone got to try and stopping him was the random passerby with a plastic bag.
Yeah.
Still one of the great heroes of that day.
Yep. And half of Melbourne's been fined for jaywalking or being on their phone while stationary at a traffic light. Why would anyone have confidence in these people?
Yeah, it's crazy.
So, yeah, there's a crisis of confidence with police in Australia, in Victoria especially, and obviously this is not going to help.
Yeah, my point is, so obviously it's like they've said, oh, this is just to meet their quote, like their targets on how many people to arrest.
Yeah,
I think targets of people to arrest is just a bad way of going about things in general.
Well, I was going
to... Like, that's a bad indicator.
I started off when I was thinking about this going, oh, this is just revenue raising that they've got, you know. But I mean, breath testing is not revenue raising. Like, drink driving is legitimately bad.
Yeah, it's not like, do that.
It's not like jaywalking. Jaywalking should be legal. Let's get that done.
Yeah, jaywalking should be rewarded. There's no more powerful you feel than when you're the only one jaywalking. You've left behind 30 slack-jawed yokels behind you.
There's no cars, people.
Yeah.
Don't be a slave.
Are you looking to the right? There is no cars coming.
Don't be a slave to that little red man or woman. Okay. Let's
don't get Evan on that one, all right? We're too close to his office to start saying gendered traffic lights.
Yep.
Cool. All right, so we'll move on to another story. So this one coming out of Michigan. The Garden Diner and Cafe
this is good.
Is this vegan Marxist restaurant in Michigan. Mm. And it's unfortunately closing down. And they've cited a few things here. Unpredictable opening hours, slow service, and a 40-minute wait for a sandwich strained customer patience, and it was hard to keep the restaurant open. The cafe, I like stuff. One of the restaurant's original investors, Tad Cummings, told the paper it's struggled to pay its own workers a turn of profit. Patrons hungry for a sandwich would find the cafe shuttered at odd times thanks to opening hours set by employee group decision. So just stuff like this of just like all the idealists are like, this is how a Marxist restaurant should run. And then that's just not viable and you can't help people.
That's right. So this is the reason this is like this is because it's not like a normal restaurant. It's like we're going to set this restaurant up by Marxist ideals.
Yeah, it's like a workers' commune, but also a restaurant.
So they didn't pay, they paid people the living wage, not the minimum wage, and they didn't have tips.
Yeah.
Right? This is America.
So obviously in America, like waiters and waitresses basically live off tips.
That's right.
So this was like, no, we're not going to do that.
And then they're like, oh, we can't pay their wages. They had, as you said, the employee thing. Like, we're going to set out opening hours by employee time so yeah. People would rock up and be like...
Don't imagine Sunday morning was a particularly busy day for this cafe.
Oh, unbelievable. Yeah. Unbelievable. One of the first things I wrote for the IPA was Strange Times, back in the IPA review, about the Occupy movement in Melbourne and how there was food shortages at their meetings.
Yeah. Hilarious. Always funny.
Hilarious stuff. Go through the archives. Have a look.
Yeah, absolutely. I also like this. So obviously, like I said before, there was a 40-minute wait for a sandwich and it was angering customers at this Marxist restaurant. I wouldn't use that as a thing to be angry about. Nothing is more on brand for a Marxist restaurant than 40-minute waits
yeah, exactly.
for bread. Like that's why you go there is yeah. to know what it was like
for the real experience.
Yeah,
and they got and they had pictures of Che Guevara on the wall and stuff like that.
Yeah, he knows what it like to wait 40 minutes for bread.
Well, he didn't have to wait.
Yeah, no. Well, he saw the people.
Him and his
from
mates
his ivory tower.
Anyway, so that was.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, it's sad that it closed down. Like, let's not be...
Oh, yeah. Like, if you want to run a Marxist restaurant and workers' commune, like, you know, good luck. Go out.
Yeah, go and do it.
Can I ask a question?
You can, Nina.
Is this a social experiment or a real business?
I think it was both at the same time, which kind of put it in a bad way.
Yeah.
Like, I think they were like, this can work. Yeah. We know this can work.
If we do this, we can prove
it. Did not work.
Never work.
I think, yeah. Oh, sorry. And one more thing about this. We felt that... Some people complained that it was too capitalist, this restaurant, because they gave free meals to the police and the police were apparently mostly male and mostly white.
No person...
So maybe they should have gone further.
No, yeah. No person thinks more of themselves than the guy criticizing the Marxist restaurant for being too capitalist.
No.
Like, no one is more happy with who they are as a person.
Let's do this properly.
Yep, cool. Pete, let's talk to Bogning.
Yeah, right. So... I don't know if you guys know this, but there's a ski resort in New South Wales called Thredbo. Probably do know that. That's banned tobogganing and, I quote, associated snow play anywhere on its property this winter season because it's dangerous. I don't know if you know this, Thredbo ski resort, but snow's really slippery and everything that happens on snow is inherently dangerous.
Absolutely.
So skiing, snowboarding... even those buddy, what are they called? The chairlifts. That's dangerous. I mean, that's just dangerous.
You see that video of the chairlift that went haywire and like couldn't slow down and was going like 20 kilometers
faster?
Oh, really?
And people had to jump off.
That was crazy.
I don't like.
Thredbo should ban that.
I don't like things like snow and heights.
When the robots fight back.
Yeah, exactly.
That's always scary. I think this is all part of Threadbow's long-term plan to run out of money.
Yeah.
To shut down all this stuff.
Threadbo?
Yeah.
Are you crazy?
Yeah, exactly. Well, also, like, to your point, the day I went skiing was absolutely the scariest day of my life.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I've never been more sure I was about to die than when I was going down a mountain skiing. On, like, the green slope as well, like, the really easy one. Never again.
I've been skiing once and I fell over 4,000 times.
Yeah, exactly. That was my day as well. So, IPA members who have just received their IPA review would have maybe seen my article at Strange Times, second reference for... Our beloved part of the IPA review.
Just plugging our own work tonight.
Yeah, exactly. But there was a school in Britain who's shut down Snowplay as well for all the danger it caused. So obviously this movement is spreading, which just makes me more timely, article.
Well, this is... You're always really tapping into the zeitgeist, James.
I do.
But this is... Snow's the next thing. Snow's the next thing that's going to go.
Yep.
Smoking. What else? Drinking.
Yep.
And
God,
snow.
God help you if you smoke on the snow. Cool. So another one that happened. So... speaking of people shutting down fun things, so I don't know if you guys would have seen the images coming out of Hawaii of the volcano that's just exploded and slowly making its way. I mean, obviously, I feel terrible for the people that have lost their houses, but no video gets... I don't click on videos quicker than I click on watch this volcano exploding or watch this volcano, like watch the lava move. Hypnotizing every time.
He's a big volcano man.
Yeah, big volcano guy. So anyway, so this came out. So Jafer tweeted at the USGS volcano, so obviously like the sort of... government authority over volcanoes. Makes them sound like gods, but they're not.
They don't control the vapor.
They don't control it.
They just watch them explode.
Yeah, and then they just tweet stuff. So he says, is it safe to roast marshmallows over volcanic vents, assuming you had a long enough stick, that is, or would the resulting marshmallows be poisonous? And the government authority tweeted back, and we're going to have to say, no, that is not safe. Please don't try. If the vent is emitting a lot of SO2 or H2S, I didn't do science. I don't know what those are.
Me neither.
They would taste bad. And if you add sulfuric acid to sugar, you get a pretty spectacular reaction. My take is USGS Volcanoes absolutely wants this guy to do this. Like, no one would tweet that if they didn't want you to do it.
Yeah.
The sentence, if you add sulfuric acid to sugar, you get a pretty spectacular reaction. Pete, there's one thing I want to do right now.
Yeah.
You might be able to guess what it is.
I know what it is.
Yeah.
The guy says long enough stick.
Yeah, mate.
So you can have a stick that's 30 kilometers long.
Yeah, look, dude, I've got a 20K stick. All right?
Yeah, let's do it.
I'm not an idiot. Also, like, you know, you're telling a guy if you do this, it's going to make a marshmallow taste bad.
Yeah.
I want to taste that marshmallow now.
Well, no one's done it, so how would they know?
Yeah, exactly. So
this is standing in the way of innovation.
No, so, well, it's standing in the way of innovation and also absolutely baiting this guy to do it.
Yeah.
So they can, yeah.
Next week, we'll tell you how he goes.
Absolutely. All right, cool. So that's it for the show this week. Thank you so much. Oh, no, we got one more thing. So, well, yeah. This story, I'm so done with this story. What are you talking about, Pete?
I don't know.
Right. I'm so done with this story. So Barnaby Joyce, obviously this has been going on for weeks. Pete and I have constantly been saying how little we care about it. No one seems to be listening. He's going to go on national TV on Sunday night.
For a tidy sum
of $150,000. Him and his new partner talking about how they fell in love and how they couldn't stop falling in love and how their new relationship is. Obviously, Pete and I don't have a whole lot of takes. Certainly not ones that we can broadcast.
We're not allowed to muckrake, James.
We're not allowed to muckrake.
We only deal in facts.
But one thing I will rake muck over is this one quote from Barnaby Joyce. So he says, this interview wouldn't be necessary if it wasn't for if Australia had stronger privacy laws.
Barnaby,
please. His theory is there's so many helicopters following around and paparazzi following around that he had no choice but to go on national TV in primetime Sunday slot.
Except
after a week's worth of promos to tell his side of the story.
Yep.
Nothing is going to get the media more to go away than doing that.
It's just those damn privacy laws.
Those damn privacy laws. I didn't want to have to tell my story for $150,000 to the nation, but those damn privacy laws made me respect my privacy so much that I'm going to broadcast all of it. Hilarious. Anyway, the problem is, like, that is going to be another a week's worth of headlines and back chat and he said, she said, and Pete and I are going to have to read them, and I'm still going to not care. Anyway, that's it for the show this week. Thank you so much for listening. So thank you so much for downloading. And thank you to Chris Berg, Ilya Shapiro, and Claire Lemon for those interviews. This podcast is available on iTunes, SoundCloud, our website, and through our Hey What Did I Miss email. Make sure you subscribe. Make sure you make sure you're telling your friends and family or anyone you think might like the podcast to get on board. If you are listening on iTunes, you can leave a rating at the top. Just give us a 5-star rating for your mates, and that would be helping us out with the rankings. And Nina, where can people go if they want to be even more involved with the IPA?
Just visit the website, ipa.org.au, and click on the join button. And starting as low as $22, you'll become a member for 12 months, and you'll receive 4 free editions of IPA Review magazines and also exclusive invitations to our events.
All right, cool. See ya.
See everyone.